he was run by a car in the desert in a hunting trip.
Right.
So this is nothing new.
If we see this happening during the rule of Mohammed bin Salman, it's basically following his grandfather's pattern.
And King Saud was overthrown by his brothers, and
right.
King Faisal was killed by his nephew.
Right.
With the encouragement of his brothers. So it's these things happen in the Saudi family.
So they maybe we can say this, Ali Al-Ahmad, that we will probably see conflict in the future within Al Saud. That this is not such a done deal. Because, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is very young. He's 37 years old. They're hoping, the Americans and the West are hoping that he will have a very long, you know, rule, being their, you know, ally there for the next 50 years. But it seems to me this is a miscalculation of things. Because I remember at that time when he became crown prince, you know, we had very senior U.S. intelligence figures like General Hayden talking about that their favorite candidate is Mohammed bin Naif, that he should
That's
be
true.
There. So it seems to me that even in America, there was different factions in America wanted different people to be the next Saudi king. And
that's true. CIA and the Democrats, and I'll just give you an example. During the Obama administration, the former head of CIA, John Brennan, mm-hmm. he was, before he became CIA, he was what they call the terrorism czar.
And, yes.
You know, he was working out of the White House. And here comes Mohammed bin Naif. At the time, Mohammed bin Naif was the assistant Minister of Interior in Saudi Arabia.
Correct.
He's not even a deputy. And he was assistant for one division, which is assistant for security affairs. He flew into D.C. several times, three times I remember. And he was taken to the White House and met with Obama. No other Saudi officials, even British official, has that pleasure. The closest country to the United States is even the Israelis at this low level were not brought into
exactly.
the White House to meet the president. But it was very clear that he was a CIA guy. They gave him, and they wanted him to be the ruler, but Mohammed bin Salman overthrew him and took power, and they didn't see it coming, honestly.
So who was supporting Mohammed bin Salman in America, in the U.S.?
It was at the time CIA, and the Democratic, a lot of Democratic side. That's why there is a lot of talk about Mohammed bin Salman and the CIA mouthpiece, like in some think tanks, called Mohammed bin Salman the epitome of counterterrorism. And I said, epitome of terrorism, you mean? Because he's not he was actually right. the person involved who planned
right.
the suicide bombings on the mosque in Qatif and Dammam.
Right.
It's all, and he exported terrorism to Iraq, and I gave evidence. It's not like I'm just saying it. I gave evidence to it.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ali Al-Ahmad? The Americans are desperately trying to consolidate the Saudi monarchy into one family, to replace the system of brotherly succession that has been the norm in the last 70 years, but which involves uncertainty and instability at the time of succession. Different factions in Washington had favored different candidates for this project, with the Democrats and the intelligence deep state favoring the now sidelined Mohammed bin Naif, and the neocons and Israelis favoring Mohammed bin Salman. Bin Salman has now arrested bin Naif, and it seems this issue has been settled for the time being, with even once very influential and elder princes such as Bandar bin Sultan now pledging allegiance to bin Salman with bended back, so they won't also end up as permanent guests in luxury hotels. If change is going to happen, it will most likely come from out of the Saudi tribe. Indeed, it seems that with the consolidation of power in one family, and with the mentioned concentration of power in the hands of people from the Najd region, the incentive for Hijazis, Eastern Shias, and Southern Najranis, Jizanis, and Asiris to seek a socio-political future beyond the tribal rule of the Saud family will intensify. It is also cynical and insulting to believe that the younger generation on the Arabian Peninsula will forego self-determination and elected government in return for such gimmicks as allowing Halloween celebrations and pop concerts. As the national liberation of once colonized peoples from around the world is reaching completion in the 21st century, and old feudal, tribal, and colonial structures are increasingly dissolving, there is no good reason why the people of the Arabian Peninsula should be an exception to this important historic process. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the 8-year holy defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view, an approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family unit and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. He would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriya High School and studied grade 7 there. And 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the Imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, "Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool." According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, "The main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB. The IRIB president says that some of the anchors were ladies and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors." Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States has yet again imposed a fresh round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, this time targeting the country's suppliers of drones Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Kos Aviation Industries. The U.S. Department of Treasury said the group, which has been under U.S. sanctions since 2013, was a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. Washington said the drones have been used to target civilian infrastructure in Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. Among those designated was Sayed Hojatollah Qureshi, Quds Aviation Industries board chairman and senior official in Iran's Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics. The Treasury said Qureshi had led Iran's military research and development efforts and was responsible for negotiating Iran's agreement with Russia for the supply of the Iranian drones for the war in Ukraine. The Treasury also imposed sanctions on Qasem Damovandian, Quds Aviation Industries' managing director and board member. It said he had likely facilitated the group's supply of drones to Iran's military services and the training of Russian personnel on the use of drones. The accusations come as Iranian officials say Ukrainians have so far failed to provide any evidence for their claim that Russia was using Iranian drones in its war on Ukraine. Speaking following a technical meeting between Ukrainian and Iranian experts, Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani said the Ukrainian side had stopped short of presenting any evidence of Russia's use of Iranian drones in its war in Ukraine. Prior to that, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had also reacted to the U.S. and other Western countries' allegations noting that Tehran had provided Moscow with a limited number of drones, but the delivery had taken place months before the war in Ukraine. The sanctions come as the U.S. Treasury says it will continue to use every tool at its disposal to deny Russian President Vladimir Putin the weapons he is using to wage his unprovoked war in Ukraine. The Friday sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization, which the Treasury claimed was the key organization responsible for overseeing Iran's ballistic missile programs. The move freezes any U.S. assets of those designated and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. Those engaged in certain transactions with the targeted individuals also risk being hit by sanctions. The United States has previously imposed sanctions on companies and people it accused of producing or transferring Iranian drones that Russia has used to attack infrastructure in Ukraine. The military-related sanctions on Iran are just a small part of the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Washington has left no stone unturned in pressuring Tehran to fulfill its demands, given that the so-called maximum pressure policy has so far failed to produce the intended result. It is widely believed that by pressuring the government and subsequently the people of Iran, what the United States is and has been pursuing after 40 years of the Islamic Revolution is seeking regime change. The sanctions against Iran over its supply of drones to Ukraine comes as the West has itself been fanning the flames of the Ukraine war by providing billions of dollars worth of military assistance to Kiev. That includes the United States, Germany, France, and the UK. The weapons they provide range from mortar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks like AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles and Abrams tanks. This is while providing Kiev with such weaponry could increase the risk of direct confrontation between Moscow and the West. Iran has been under the UN and US sanctions since the 1979 revolution. What comes to the spotlight is the futility of such all-out anti-Tehran measures. Despite 40 years of pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Republic, not only Iran has not stopped, but it has progressed, so the sanctions tactic has lost its effectiveness in a sense. This rather indicates that the United States seems to be escaping the frustration caused by its failure against the Iranian nation's iron will. The resilience of Iran's economy is not the only reason why the unlawful American maximum pressure campaign of sanctions against Tehran has failed. The maximum pressure policy against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Donald Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to strike a better agreement, which he hoped would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Eventually, his hopes and aspirations became more and more far-fetched with each passing day. Now, the Trump-imposed sanctions regime has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. Could this be because they see no alternative course of action? What seems to be of very high significance is the fact that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only didn't work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena. Yet Iran stands. How so? Iran's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives to circumvent such U.S. measures.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2022 because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the globe will slide into a recession next year as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, You cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as the new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries, that it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected. Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he'll be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means they those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractious support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP, between swing and district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. Crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears the fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used for this, and based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached. But if you do not have a law for a certain situation, quickly make a law. These are important things and is among very important issues. Of course, sometimes the judiciary itself is the source of some of the news. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a people. Sometimes a member of the judiciary mentions something about a person or about an organization, and his statements affect public opinion. The last thing I would like to recommend is for you to follow up on the files you open and to finish them. Finish the various cases involving public affairs that the judiciary has started. For example, about some factories, some illegal seizures, and the like. You shouldn't open a wound and leave it untreated. Of course, there is usually a big commotion in the beginning when something like this is being done. Then it is slowly forgotten. Whatever you start, whatever issue it is, he mentioned central issues. Central issues are very good. Especially pursue them because of their priority. Finish the matter and complete the case. Then you can move aside.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Your work is hard, truly hard. Indeed, the work of the judiciary is one of the jobs that is very difficult. I have been in the ongoing executive affairs of the revolution since the beginning of the revolution. I have always said that I am afraid of accepting to be in charge of matters related to the judiciary branch. And I have avoided doing so because this is a very difficult job and it is very demanding. You have taken on much work on yourselves. Well, the reward for this is just as much. That is, in proportion to the amount of the work that is done. The divine reward that is given is also just as much, God willing. Follow up on the work that is being done for the sake of God. Follow up on work while benefiting from divine guidance. God willing, you will be given the divine reward. You may do a good action at times and no one realizes it, not even your manager or your boss. Your subordinates may not understand what you have done either. For example, you may have worked a few hours overtime, or maybe you did a job carefully, or perhaps you fought diligently against corruption and dishonesty. No one may realize what you have done, but God's scribes realize.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces shot dead 16-year-old Amer Ghazi Mahmoud Zaytoun this year during a raid on Balata refugee camp outside Nablus in the northern-occupied West Bank. Amer is the third Palestinian child killed by Israeli regime forces in 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, in just a few days of the new year, the Zionist regime killed 4 Palestinians, including 3 children. The Zionist regime troops killed a 16-year-old boy in the Balata refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus overnight. Defense for Children International, Palestine, identified the boy as Amer Ghazi Zaytoun. He was shot with a bullet to the head. Recently, the Zionist regime occupation forces, accompanied by undercover Mistarivim agents, invaded the Shia refugee camp near the West Bank city of Beit Lahem to capture a camp resident. The group present themselves as Palestinians in order to capture, injure, or infiltrate groups of civilians. Camp residents confronted the troops, according to DCIP, and were shot at with live ammunition, rubber-coated steel bullets, and tear gas canisters. During the raid, the Zionist regime troops positioned themselves on the rooftops in order to place snipers there, according to a field investigation by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. 5 children gathered and threw stones at the Zionist regime troops on the one rooftop. An eyewitness told PCHR, the Zionist regime troops opened fire on the children and another group of men, injuring 2 children who were taken to a nearby hospital. One of the injured was 15-year-old boy Adam Issam Ayad. He was shot with at least 1 bullet in the back of his shoulder. DCIP reported he later died of his wounds. The Israeli regime troops invaded Kfar Dan in the northern West Bank on January 2nd to demolish the homes of 2 Palestinians accused of killing an Israeli force in September. Ahmad Ayman Abed and Abdurrahman Hani Abed reportedly opened fire on the Zionist troops near Jenin that month using improvised Carlo rifles, killing Bar Falah, the deputy commander of a special reconnaissance unit in Nahal Brigade. Both men were killed by the Zionist regime army. The Zionist forces arrived in Kfar Dan to destroy the men's family homes as punishment for their relatives. Collective punishment of this kind is a war crime that the fabricated regime of Israel only commits against the families of Palestinians accused of harming Israelis, never against the families of Israelis who harm Palestinians. The Zionist regime troops forced the occupants of the 2 houses as well as 10 other families to vacate in preparation for the punitive demolition, according to PCHR. The Zionist regime forces completely destroyed 1 home, leaving 3 families, a total of 17 people, homeless. They destroyed 2 floors of the other house. Villagers gathered to confront the Zionist troops, throwing stones at them. Troops responded with live fire, tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber-coated steel bullets. 6 people were injured, including Fa'ad Mahmoud Abed, 17, who later died in hospital. According to a field investigation by DCIP, an Israeli sniper stationed on the 2nd floor of a house shot the boy in the abdomen, pelvis, and legs. Mahmoud Samer Hoshia, 22, from Al Yamun village, was also killed in the incursion. He was shot in the chest, according to PCHR. The fabricated regime of Israel appears bent on keeping up the same rate of killings in the first week of 2023 as a particularly violent 2022. Last year saw the highest number of Palestinians killed by Israeli regime forces and Zionist settlers in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, since the Second Intifada nearly 2 decades ago. Violence and provocations against Palestinians have certainly not abated since Benjamin Netanyahu's new coalition government was sworn in last month, in a highly provocative act, the Zionist National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir of the supremacist Jewish Power Party stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound recently. The move drew rebukes from the Zionist closest allies, including the U.S. and Arab regimes, because it threatens a status quo that otherwise serves only the Zionist interest. Such incursions are associated with the so-called Temple Movement that promotes Jewish visits to Al-Aqsa in the occupied East Al-Quds as part of a gradual takeover process by Zionist settlers. The ultimate aim of the movement, openly declared by many of its adherents, is the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock and their replacement with a Jewish temple, as they claim. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported at least two Palestinians were injured by Zionist regime occupation forces during the weekly anti-colonization protest in the village of Kfar Qaddoum in the West Bank province of Galilea, local sources have said. Murad Shoveti, a local anti-occupation activist, told Wafa that Israeli regime occupation forces attacked the protesters with rubber-coated rounds and tear gas canisters, injuring two Palestinians by rubber-coated rounds and causing many cases of suffocation from gas inhalation among civilians, including children. The injured protesters were treated at the scene by local medics. For many years, villagers from Kfar Qaddoum and neighboring villages have been holding weekly protests every Friday against illegal Israeli settlement construction. More than 650,000 Israeli settlers live in Jewish-only settlements across the occupied Palestinian territories in violation of international law.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Braving the bone-chilling weather, mourners are remembering those who gave their lives for the future of this region and beyond.
These people gathered here to pay tribute to martyrs to the war against the key terrorist groups in the region who were backed by the U.S.
General Qasem Soleimani was remembered as a hero for humanity, who transcended geographical and ethnic boundaries, and whose campaign against the Daesh terrorist groups saved every Muslim and non-Muslim country, including Pakistan.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani is a way of life and a school of thought to fight the enemies of the Muslim world and the East. If the world of Islam and countries in the East want to save themselves from the malicious designs of the West aimed at breaking this region into pieces to create its new world order, then they have to follow Qasim Soleimani and the strategies he used to save the West Asia region from the collapse.
Speakers at the gathering shed light on different dimensions of martyr Soleimani's life and his legacy, as well as how it impacted the region.
The U.S. and its Western allies had remained helpless and in despair in the face of global terrorism. Martyr Qasim Soleimani put an end to the darkness of this hopelessness vis-a-vis U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorism.
Some 70,000 Pakistani citizens have been killed at the hands of U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorists, including in attacks on schools and children. These were the same terrorists that General Soleimani took out in an anti-terror campaign for which he will always be remembered. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through a terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration, and it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government